Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit. And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 164. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Thrillers.
Mysteries.
Crime.
And suspense. Where did that come from?
I don't know why that was so high-pitched.
Well, I know why it's high-pitched, because you're mega stressed. And by the way, happy Mothering Sunday.
Oh, thank you.
And you've been spoiled. I mean, just
far. Yes. They're not awake yet, so I know there's stuff, but I haven't opened it.
Looks really good. And, you know, credit to them. They've really done a great job.
Yeah, they're very sweet.
I'm very lucky. That is lovely. And anyway, welcome to the show. And we ought to introduce our guest, who is
He's a good one.
Well, this, you know, we spoke to him at London Book Fair 2 years ago, and it just happens to be London Book Fair week, and indeed, he will be there. We're talking about J.D. Kirk, otherwise known as Barry Hutchison, but we will refer to him as J.D. throughout this interview. J.D. Kirk has absolutely dominated the independent publishing crime scene for 4 or 5 years now.
Yeah. He's
alongside L.J. Ross and Rach McLean and one or two others. I mean, he is a behemoth.
He's one of the big guns.
Absolutely.
But he's a very modest big gun, isn't he?
He is a modest big gun, and he's one of the most productive human beings in the world.
Incredible.
We're training this particular interview as 5 novels, 3 screenplays, no sweat, because that's what he's that's what he's doing this year. That's his plan.
Yeah.
5 novels, 3 Hollywood screenplays, not just sort of like, you know, things knocked out and hoping that they're going to get published. He knows that his screenplays are going to be made into films, and he's got to write them.
Yeah. But he seems quite relaxed about it, doesn't he? I think that was the thing that got me. He's just like, yeah, I'm doing this. This is my plan. And
just an astonishing.
Whereas if that was you, you'd be running around like a headless chicken.
I am in the process of running around. We'll explain why we're both feeling like headless chickens just this minute. But J.D. Kirk is our guest, and it's a massive pleasure. And I can't tell you how much you're going to get. I mean, just so much stuff that we covered, and it's truly inspirational. We've got some awesome guests. We've had some recently, and, you know, this is just up there.
Do you know what I love about our podcast is we have a really interesting blend of people we don't know and we interview them, only knowing what we can gather on the internet.
Yep.
We have people who we know very well who are good friends of ours, and we have people like J.D. Kirk who we know reasonably well. We've met a few times or once or twice or whatever, but they are sort of stars in their field, you know, and so the span of guests we have, and we learn something new from every single one.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So listen to all the back episodes, 163 of them, including our excellent interview with Guy last week.
Yeah, another one that was great.
It was.
And Guy's
Guy
a friend,
yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right, so let's get into news. Now, I'm going to avoid the S word this week.
The S word. Oh, that S word.
Yeah.
Oh, so when you're
a bit, sweet,
it's a teenage complexion and a buzzy thing.
Yes, very good. Well, kind of buzzy thing. I mean, anyway, we're not going to talk about them this week because I just had enough of it. And I'm sure you have, listening to my rants about it. However, we're going to talk about something which is really, well, on the subject, on the face of it, it's really dry. And
paint.
You might think, why are we talking about this? But you can explain. You work, as we've, you know, mentioned every time, you've got a number of clients in the publishing world on the freelance side of your life.
And indeed, I've added a few recently as well. But you have been working in nonfiction for Oxford University Press forever.
Yeah, for over 20 years. So it was my first sort of proper job in publishing. And I haven't been able to let go of the company. I mean, you know, they will let go of me at some point, and I think I will grieve.
Well, you have this thing dangling threat, you know, the changes they're making, which means that you won't do the thing that you're doing, and you might be, that might be it.
Yeah.
And so therefore, a lot of what has been the emphasis of your life in the last 18 months is to diversify your client base.
Yes.
And to compensate for the potential loss of your regular monthly work. You've had that.
I've had it for
like clockwork.
Yeah, so I've been doing the regular work. I think Josh was one when I was approached about this regular working for the online subscription.
And he turned 18 last week, so there you go. Some indication of
how long
we're talking.
So it's a big part of my life, yes.
It is, yeah.
And, yeah, they've been dangling this. We won't need you at some point for 2 years now. So now, not holding my breath yet.
Is this story related to
no.
why that way? Okay, well, what we're talking about, we're sort of going around the houses talking about, is that your work for AUP has been impacted by some major changes under the bonnet of European publishing.
Well,
in worldwide publishing. I don't know.
Not quite, but...
Tell us what we're talking about here.
Okay, so the last couple of weeks, I've had emails from people saying things like, I ask them if they can change something in the systems, and they say...
Nope.
Well, they say, we can do it before the 1st of March. And then since the 1st of March, I've had emails saying, I will keep that in a file to do after the freeze.
And I was thinking, freeze?
What is the freeze?
That sounds like something out of Doctor Who.
So I did ask that. I said, what is this freeze of which you speak?
The freeze.
And they said, oh, it's the new ERP system that we're implementing at AUP.
Right.
And I said, what is the ERP system?
Okay, so on behalf of the audience, what is the ERP system?
Okay, so... there's this, I'm going to get really geeky now.
Okay.
And it's not just publishing. Lots of companies use a software called SAP. If you call it SAP, you get told off by an SAP expert.
SAP stands for?
I don't know.
Right. Okay, I'll look that up while you're talking.
I call it SAP. I've always called it SAP, but I have a friend who works for SAP, and he always tells me off when I say SAP. Anyway. It's a system for keeping data and... it's a managing system, basically. So OUP has used SAP for years. Like when I worked there full time, they used it, and it's just for storing all the ISBNs and the important metadata internally, and it feeds into external systems.
Right.
Okay. I know that's a bit geeky. Go on then. What have you found?
Well, no. I'm just looking at I'm just getting the page up now. But SAP Business One ERP for SMEs from Sidor.
So the ERP. So they're basically upgrading what they've been using, the version of SAP, to what's now called SAP Enterprise Resource Planning.
Right.
So it's just a new way of doing everything. So the finance, invoicing, managing.
I'm staggered here because on their front page of the people who make SAP, 1.2 million daily users of SAP.
Yeah. So it's any company, you know, it's not just publishing. I used to think it was just publishing until I met the SAP person who said, oh, no, I work for all sorts of companies worldwide. It's a big thing. It's the sort of thing that if it isn't working,
okay,
it's a big deal.
Right. So it's used for accounting, sales and purchasing data. It's also used for customer data and marketing campaign tools. And it's also used in warehousing and production.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And purchasing and procurement. I mean, essentially, SAP is a big deal.
Yes. So while they're upgrading, and this was an article in the Bookseller, so I couldn't find out that much information.
This is the staggering thing, is that people are saying, well, of course, you know, it's the big freeze. can't do anything until the freeze is over. You know, we're frozen out at the moment. All those sort of things.
And I didn't.
And you were asking people, what? What does that mean? Not in that awful voice, but you know what I mean. And they couldn't answer.
Yeah, there's a peculiar culture about OUP, which is part of its charm.
Oxford University Press.
Sorry, we've been talking about it.
I know, but there's enough acronyms.
That's part of it. So Oxford University Press love acronyms. I remember my first meeting, and they were talking about the OED, the ODWI. You won't know what ODWI is.
Well, what is it?
Oxford Dictionary of Writers for Writers and Editors.
I mean, we know the OED is the Oxford English Dictionary.
But all the dictionaries have acronyms, and all the sort of big books have acronyms, and lots of the systems have acronyms. It was like another language. So they love acronyms there.
I'm going to break in just for a second, because you sent me an acronym this morning, right? And I couldn't figure out what it meant. So this is on Messenger. And you sent me WWYLTDTP question mark.
Yes.
And I went, you've gone mad. And then I figured this out. When would you like to do the podcast?
Correct.
And I replied with WWILTRPTPNSYSWCA, which was, when would I like to record the podcast? Not sure yet. Soon.
Oh, soon. I thought that was sorry.
When WCA stood for When Cat Allows, because you were pinned to, you couldn't get off the bed because the cat was sitting on you.
So I was lying in bed with a cat on my knee and I couldn't move. But WCA, you stumped me with that. I did not know what that meant.
Yeah, it wasn't anything rude for once. Anyway, so acronyms can dominate your life if you let them.
Yes.
And Oxford University Press love them.
They do. And it's almost like everybody... And we've like established they know what they all mean, but they're too embarrassed to
say.
Right,
and so we've established that SAP is a software at the centre of a lot of commerce, including the publishing industry. And what's changing?
So, well, they're upgrading to the new version, the new enterprise resource planning. You see, I mean, even...
ERP.
Yeah. So while they're doing that, they can't use it. As simple as that. They can't use SAP. So all the things that it does for them...
Blimey.
It's frozen for a period of time.
So... In a way, what we're looking at, particularly in your sector of publishing, if I were to make an analogy, it's a bit like how we all approached the millennium, not knowing if the millennium bug was going to cause planes to fall out of sky and ventilators to stop in hospitals and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It didn't work out that way.
No.
But, boy, a lot of people made a lot of money doing it. Equally, I remember I had friends in the city who had to prepare for when the euro launched. The amount of work, 2 years of planning that went in to make sure that when currencies coagulated into the euro in Europe, it didn't bring down the London stock market or any of that sort of thing. So there are examples where there have been big technological, and indeed, the Big Bang, which was, do you remember when the City of London stopped being purely through the stock exchange and people waving hands and stuff, and it became an electronic trading system, and trading rooms were set up. So it's in a quiet way, and maybe not as major a thing, but it's up there. It's a similar sort of cliff that everyone's hanging over at the moment.
And the interesting thing is that in the article in the bookseller, it says it doesn't affect digital services. So the area of Oxford University Press I work for is the online platform, so digital publishing of books. And it will affect that, because it affects the publication dates of physical copies, because they can't process. So that impacts on what you can put online. So it's one of those things where you think it has an impact and you think the impact is contained and you think you can communicate the impact.
Yeah, you can ring fence it.
But actually, it feeds into so many other areas.
Well, do you remember a few months ago, Waterstones did a back office change to the way that they supplied the stores with a new computer system, and it caused havoc, and suddenly they had no stock because they couldn't get any in. It's not dissimilar, is it?
No, and I think it's just one of those things where you can try and imagine the impact, and I know there are people that
and you can try and ameliorate and anticipate.
And they have got things in place. Problems. Yeah, they've got things in place to sort of deal with the impact of a freeze. But I think people very rarely get it completely right, and it's just you can't. Cause sometimes you can't.
It's going to cause havoc. It will do. Yeah. It'll have ripples, because that's the nature of it. When I was at the BBC, we had various times when there were things like this, massive overhaul of systems that we used. And the most obvious example on, I think, twice in my career, we changed the way that the systems we used to produce news and got it on air. And it moved from something which was very basic called Basis, which was, real old school computing, which is where we used to write all our stories, and it was like a word processor, but would appear in on teleprompters and things like that. Then it moved to ENPS, the Electronic News Production System, which was a massive upgrade, but nonetheless took us months. You know, there were tons of times when I remember Five Live just falling off air practically because nothing would play out of the playout system. So, and you know, the newsreader would introduce a clip for the Prime Minister and it just wouldn't play. Well, we'll come back to that later. That sort of thing was going on. It was carnage. And then they moved to another system just before I left, which was Open Media as opposed to EMPS. And all of this was designed to reflect the new technology available that wasn't available when it was first designed, and also to save money because of the licensing. EMPS cost £5,000 per user per year. It was an enormous expense if you think about the thousands of people using it in the BBC. So they decided to get something which they could get off the shelf, 100 million quid, done.
And of course, like
the worst example of something that went wrong at the BBC was something called DMI, which was supposed to be the digital media infrastructure, I think it was called, which was to digitize all the tapes that sat in the bottom, in the basement of Television Centre. Everything that was ever sort of put out through Television Centre, like all the sport and everything like that, were all on tape. Mm. What they were going to do was ingest all of that material and have a digital content system that the whole of the BBC could access it, you know, whenever they wanted, just like that, rather than having all these libraries and librarians. And it cost 100 million quid. And it never saw the light of day. It was one of the biggest wastes of money in public systems, you know, like the NHS computer systems get changed.
Yeah.
So anyway, look, we've digressed, but essentially the freeze is happening now.
Yeah, it started on the 1st of March.
And I wonder how long is it scheduled to last?
Well, I couldn't get a concrete answer on that either. Around about a month, possibly 6 weeks. What I worry about is once the freeze is over and the new system's in place, all the backup. Backlog of jobs, because I've been getting lots of emails. I've been getting lots of emails, and this is just me, a freelancer, saying I will park that until the freeze is over. I think, crikey, they're going to come to work on the first day and have this massive pile to get through.
Yeah, that's it. I suppose it's the pain, natural pain that you have to go through to bring things up to date. But
yeah, short term chaos for long term gain. I mean, yeah, it's true.
Wow. Wowie, lots of things are going to fall through those cracks. I wonder if it's going to be a conversation point at London Book Fair this week.
Possibly, yeah.
It could be. Anyway, we're heading there this week. We've got a busy week ahead. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But London Book Fair, no doubt, will throw up quite a few stories for us to talk about next week.
Oh, I'm sure of that. Yeah, we'll update everybody on that next week.
Absolutely. No, we wanted to, you know, finish the news section with something really
nice news.
Positive, which was, I think we mentioned this a few months ago, the prospect of a crime and true crime and crime fiction specific bookshop opening in the UK in York.
In York, yes.
And it opened this week. Criminally good.
Yeah, and we can't wait to visit.
Yeah, we will. We're going to make a pilgrimage up there and we'll try and get them on the show. From what I can see, it's the passion of one particular sort of person who's launched themselves into retail, who loves crime books and whatever. It looks a spectacularly lovely shop, and all power to them, criminally good. So that is a really positive thing, because let's be honest, independent bookshops run well, can do very really well, and I know a few that are, but others are closing, and so this is a really fabulous,
there's lovely news.
Yeah, congratulations to them. They've been doing loads of media, causing quite a splash, and can't wait to visit. Looks beautiful.
Yeah, we will. We'll go visit. Or we'll take our microphones.
Right. Talking about things that are criminally good, this interview with J.D. Kirk is spectacularly good. And I'm sure you'll come away from it, just as we did, feeling really inspired. And, I mean, Barry Hutchison, who is his crime fiction name, J.D. Kirk, has made an enormous impact in the marketplace. But unlike some of his contemporaries who've done really well as indies, he's not been going down the traditional route with his books, which some of them have. And The reason he says that is because he wants to keep control and he loves the indie life.
He's
actually had about 150 books published as a traditional published author. He's incredibly productive. That comes through this. I mean, 5 novels, 3 screenplays this year, and he's had a bit of a bumpy start to the year because of family issues. So even that's still his schedule. It's incredible. And yet, as you'll find out from this interview, there's no cutting corners here. He just is incredibly quick at writing. And he has
a special superpower. Which we talk about, so let's...
Yeah, we'll get to that now. So let's speak to the brilliant J.D. Kirk.
We love having people back.
We do.
On the podcast book show we did last week, and we are this week. And
I don't know why they come back, but they do.
It's always a pleasure and a really big privilege to speak to J.D. Kirk. Welcome to the show again.
Hello, lovely to be back. Yeah, and you didn't even have to trick me into it or anything.
No, we didn't have to sort of thrust our microphones in your face and say, do you fancy a chat?
Yeah, because that's kind of what happened last time, wasn't it? So I got press ganged at the London Book Fair. But here I am with my own free will now. So
yeah,
here
we go. And then we had planned to speak to you a few months ago, but things got in the way.
I know, I think this is the third attempt, isn't it? Because
yeah, I think so.
you were unwell at one of them. I had a last-minute ticket to an Independent Publishers Guild autumn conference, which, you know, it was like worth £300. So I was like,
absolutely. Priorities.
Yeah, sorry about that. You got shunted for the
That's
IPG.
That's quite right. I think you've been the right decision.
But it's always terrific to speak to you because, I mean, you know, we were going to say probably the first time you were booked on to speak to us, you had a book out, but chances are, the way that your release rate, there's probably something fresh for us to talk about on this occasion.
Yeah, Paul's got a book out. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So, in that regard, we'll touch on that in a moment. But when we spoke to you a couple of years ago at the London Book Fair, you were hinting to us that you were going to go into the romance sector. Has that happened?
Yes, it has. There's some interesting news on that front, actually. So, my wife and I, we kind of had some ideas. Well, the reason it came about is I write Scottish crime fiction and I get a surprising number of emails from usually sort of older middle-aged women lusting after some of the characters in the books, quite graphically lusting after some of the characters in the books. And I thought, right, okay, well, you know, is there an audience there? Is a crossover audience for readers interested in romance with a similarly sort of strong Scottish character? And my wife and I came up with this series called the Lackert Isle series, and it's set on this sort of fictional island off the west coast of Scotland. And we collaborated, came up with the idea. We kind of got the first couple of books done. There's 2 books out at the moment, under the name Jessica Burnley, which is my wife's idea. And they've been doing all right, they've been doing fine. But the interesting bit of news is that without naming them, probably the world's largest romance movie studio has picked up the rights to them.
Oh, that's fantastic.
My wife and I have been convinced to co-write the screenplays for them. So it will be three movies based on the Lackert Isle series.
Oh, amazing.
That's brilliant. That's really great news. Oh, congratulations.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I'm sure I can officially announce all the details soon, but not quite yet.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you can figure it out. You know, I'm not going to...
You've narrowed it down a fair bit, yeah.
So that's happening. That's happening this year. So basically, my schedule at the moment, I am due to write 5.5 books because one book I'm half finished. So 5.5 books and 3 feature-length screenplays this year. So I don't intend to sleep very much.
No,
I was going to say, I mean, at that point, my jaw started to hit the floor. But, you know, this is one of the things that you're known for, and one of your great attributes is the speed of release and the speed at which you write. And, you know, delving into your secret, I mean, you recently found out that you have a thing that is not unique.
A mental thing.
Yes, a mental thing that actually is your superpower for writing. And I, you know, I'm not very good at the medical name, so perhaps you'd introduce it. But this is something where you can't create pictures in your mind of a scenario or a, you know, a beach scene or whatever it is. But that means that you're thinking in words, and that actually speeds up your creative process.
That's certainly my theory on it. Anyway, it's called aphantasia.
That's it. Yeah.
And it means a lack of visual images. So, well, mental images. Visual images are just things you see. Mental images.
Yes.
And it came about, I was on holiday with my family, just trying enough at the best of times. But it was my son had said something, and I can't remember exactly what he said, but it made me realise that he was talking about seeing things in his mind, like seeing pictures inside his head. And I thought, what are you talking about? That's madness. And he insisted that he could see it. And he was kind of looking at me like I was the weird one. And then I kind of went to my wife and daughter and says, can you believe that he thinks he can see things in his head? And they were both like, well, yes, what are you talking about? And I realised that I was the one that thought differently. And they reckon kind of 8 to 10% of the population fit into this sort of category. It's basically, it's like most things in life, it's a spectrum. And at one end is people with hyperphantasia, who can basically, you know, almost like Tony Stark in Iron Man, can conjure something there in front of them, can rotate it and all that. And they're, as far as their brain's concerned, they're seeing that thing up there. And then there's that sort of sliding scale that goes down to people, you know, if you can shut your eyes and picture being on a beach, for example, and you'll be able to see trees and sky, and maybe you'll hear birds or any of that stuff. And then it kind of goes down to darkness at the other end. So if you say close your eyes and picture a blue circle, I will close my eyes and I will think of the word blue in my mind, and I will think of the word circle, and we'll see nothing. And I might think of other kind of attributes that go with that. I might go, oh, sphere, or, you know, different shades of blue or whatever. I'm thinking of the names of them, but there's nothing picturing them in any way. There is nothing but black behind my eyes or in my mind's eye. And I think exclusively in words, and realize I always have done. And I remember my, you know, when I was younger, suddenly things made sense. So when I was younger, my dad would say, if you can't sleep, go and count sheep. And I go, what are you talking about? What sheep? You know, there are no sheep to count. What are you on about? Or in primary school, my teacher would say, right, imagine you've got three apples in that hand and four apples in that hand. Count the apples. And I'm going, I haven't got any apples. What are you on about? And it was that if other people were visualizing apples then and going, okay, one, two, three, four, and counting them. But I couldn't do that. And I didn't kind of understand it. And I never really thought too much about it because, you know, I've always said, oh, I'll picture that and do. But there's no picture. It's just that's the language we use to say, I will think about that thing. So if I'm trying to describe a scene, you know, I've spoken to a lot of authors who will kind of imagine that scene in their mind and they will see that scene and they will go and describe all the details in that location based on what they're seeing. So they're going, okay, let me look at that thing again. Almost like a landscape artist. You're going, I'll look at that, but I'm seeing it in my mind and then I will describe it. I skip that step. I don't see anything. For me, the whole idea of that landscape or that picture or that scene starts in words. So it's very quick to then just write it down. I don't have that sort of extra step of translating picture into words and then typing those words out. It just goes words, boom, they're on the page.
Yeah. So that's a speedy thing. But, you know, some would say, and depending on the author, some spend a lot of time, you know, they're proud of their descriptive hours and, you know, creating the pictures for people in their minds. But I mean, in a sense, as a reader, if you're reading a book, you're not getting those pictures.
I skip over. If there's big chunks of description, I skip over because I'll go, okay, they're in a room. That's what I need to know. You know, I don't need to, don't describe the curtains to me because I can't see them. So you're wasting my time. So I love, when I'm reading, I love dialogue and, you know, and things happening. But I also love the rhythm of words. Like a sentence to me is like if you've, you know, just flipping two words in a sentence and the other way around can make it music, which is kind of in what I'm sort of hearing in my head when I read. So it's very much the words and the characters and things. The description of the scenes, I don't care. However, I get a lot of people because I write about the Highlands of Scotland, and I can, you know, I do describe the scene. I go, okay, I know what's out my window, you know, and I can describe mountains and snow on the top, and I can describe all that stuff without seeing it, just by remembering what's out there as a list almost. So I bag a lot of people who will get in touch and say that they felt they were watching a movie. They were transported to the Highlands, and that's how, and that's something, it's interesting that I'm clearly able to create that or give that to someone else, but I can't get that. I read it and I'm just seeing words on a page, and I might appreciate the rhythm of those words and it might give me information, but it's not creating a movie in my mind that, you know, that a lot of people get when they're reading.
That's fascinating. You'd find my mind a bit strange because I have synesthesia, which means that every letter of the alphabet has a colour.
Yeah, that is interesting. My wife's almost at the opposite end of the spectrum to me. So if she, you know, if she's lost something, in her mind, she will backtrack through the house and she'll go, okay, so I'm there and I'm now there and I'm now there and there I am. If she was, we were trying to remember the name of someone who we're kind of friends with before, you know, years ago, and she'd seen her Facebook profile like kind of, you know, 6 months previously. So she essentially called up that Facebook profile in her mind, looked at the picture, and then looked at the name next to it and got the name that way, which to me feels like witchcraft, you know, it's like that. So we're at opposite ends of the spectrum on that. However, and it seems to be a recurring theme with people with aphantasia, I have an amazing sense of direction, and I can find my way around things, like without, I can go, okay, so we're there, we need to go there, here are the three different routes we can take to get there. My wife will walk out of a shop and turn the wrong direction to go
home.
Yeah,
I do the same.
So she's the opposite end, yeah.
In fact, the other day we walked out of, I don't know what it was, but I went one way and noticed you'd gone the other way and thought, oh, yeah.
That's where we live, yeah.
Yeah.
So
now, I've got an awful sense of direction. But if you said to me, there's a cat on the corner, so turn right at left at the cat, and then there's a red pub opposite the cat, and then there's a gate. And if you did it that way, I a fair chance of getting it right. But if you just say,
no, see, for me,
yeah, if you just say turn left, then 300 yards, turn right, turn left, then
Well, for me, it's more like I was trying to explain it to my son the other day when we were driving through Edinburgh, because I was like, oh, yeah, okay, so we're going, we need to get here, and that road's blocked. So I just knew which direction we had to go and which roads were, even though it was an area I was completely unfamiliar with. I just went, okay, so we go that way, that way, that way, and then we'll be there. And he says, well, how do you know that without seeing anything? Because, and I realized, and this is going to sound mad, but I realized that it's almost like a series of itches somewhere in my brain that's like, okay, that's how to get there. So he reckons maybe it's like, you know how birds have got that sort of magnetic, they follow. He reckons it's that. He reckons that I've got a bird brain in there somewhere that's guiding me.
That's interesting. Yeah, maybe there's something in that.
Well, I'm with you sort of halfway. I mean, I recognize that in the way that I find directions, but it, equally, if it goes off kilter, and you know, I'm in an unfamiliar place, and but somehow my geography's thrown out, then it scrambles me totally. The other day we were driving to Wakefield to go to a book launch, and I decided that we were going to do some particular route, and somehow we ended up back on the M6, which was exactly the thing I wanted to avoid.
I didn't even know we were on the motorway because I was off in the Paris.
It was, you know, you might as well have held a gun to my firstborn because I was so agitated by the fact that I'd messed up.
I didn't care. He kept apologising to me, and I thought, I don't mind. I'm just sat here on my laptop. Just carry on.
That's what Stoke does to you, anyway.
Interestingly, L.J. Ross, crime author L.J. Ross, her husband also has aphantasia and has an amazing sense of direction, which he can't explain either. So my theory is that it's connected in some way.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I read a book, and it mentioned the thing that birds have. So it's like an extra sense.
Yeah.
We just don't have a science name for it yet, you know, but it exists.
But aphantasia is quite a recent term, isn't it? I think it was only sort of coined 8-9 years ago
by
researchers in Exeter. So, yeah, interesting. I mean, so that is something, you know, many, many authors would find listening to this will be thinking, God, I couldn't cope with that. I really couldn't. But in terms of the speed at which you get words down, does, you know, you've not got that extra element getting in the way of
you know, translating there to,
so it's a shortcut
to keyboard.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's also because, like, if I had been seeing pictures all this time and then suddenly lost that ability, then that'd be a very different thing. You know, that'd be a... But I have just always thought like this. I assumed everyone always thought like this. So I don't see, you know, I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything necessarily. It's just, that's just how my brain works.
Now, in terms of screenwriting, which you've got a big set of screenplays to do, I mean, clearly one of the things that a screenwriter has to do is establish the scene, and the director then interprets from that, yeah, how they're going to set dress it. So is that a help or a hindrance, what you're, when you're doing that process? Clearly dialogue is something that you're very strong with, and,
yeah, yeah,
and that's the
I would nugget. Say it helps, yeah, because really you don't want to overdo description in a screenplay, because you know you want as few words as possible on the page to slow it down. So establishing the scene will be literally, you know, interior bedroom day, you know, and then say, you know, the room's a mess, curtains are open, there's you know, empty pizza boxes lying everywhere, and then you get into the action. So you don't have to actually go, you don't try and, you know, create any sort of emotion from that scene. You're just laying down the bare facts of that scene, and that's very, very easy for me. It's just, I can go, what is an untidy room going to be like? And I can almost, from a sort of Rolodex of descriptions and, you know, words in my head, I go, okay, this is what that room would look like. But I'm never seeing it at any point. You know, that's why. And that's why when people say, you know, who do you picture to play this character? And if there was, this was going to be a movie or a TV series, yeah, who would play this character? No idea. I don't know what they look like. You know, like DCI Logan is a big guy with a coat, and that's my entire understanding of what he looks like. You know, I couldn't tell you his hair color. It's never been mentioned, and I couldn't tell you what it is, but my readers could. They will argue what he looks like. They will say, it's definitely not him, it's him. And then, you know, a few hundred will go, oh yeah, you're right. But then someone else will say, no, I think it's him. And they're all seeing it, you know, but I'm not. So I'm always fascinated when they say, this is who we think he looks like. And it's like, all right, okay, cool. That's like, I'm seeing him for the first time.
Fascinating.
It's interesting because in my head, I've got the untidy bedroom with the curtains and the pizza boxes, and I can see it all over there.
Yeah, see, no, not, nothing. Gone from my head completely until you mentioned it there. Just, wow. it was.
Now, I mean, one of the things you've done since we last spoke is create a course for writers.
Yes.
Because if nothing else, I mean, you have been besieged, I'm sure, by other independent authors, particularly saying, how have you done it?
So what's your secret? Magic?
It's what we were digging at when we spoke to you at London Book Fair, in a sense. And we were talking about marketing, because you're on the, featuring on the Amazon stand, and a lot of the people there are, you know, that take part in this, like Rachel McLean or Mark Dawson or whatever, have all managed to crack some aspect of making the books sing and get out there and selling in huge numbers. But doing that process of creating a course must have given you a rare opportunity, given how much you're working, to actually reflect on how you've done it and what you do.
Yes, it did a bit. So the course, the reason I actually did it in the first place was that I was getting, you know, a few dozen emails every week from people both on my sort of JD Kirk reader mailing list who were interested in writing a book or had written a book and didn't know what to do with it, or people who were just indie authors who kind of seen that I've had some success and were interested in replicating that. But most of the people that were getting in touch were beginners, were people that were like, how do I actually get started in this? So back in 2000 and... I don't know when it was. There was the 20 Books to 50K London event, 2017, 2018, something like that. I spoke there, and I got stuck on a motorway at that point as well, I should say. But I spoke there about how I kind of started my Space Team series, how I self-published it with no money, because I was a children's author at that point. I was penniless. I was writing for multiple different publishers. I'd written 180 odd books and was perpetually broke. So I thought, well, I can't afford to spend any money on this, but I want to give it a go and do. So I did a lot of time, I spent a lot of time researching. I listened to, you know, thousands of podcasts, read hundreds of websites and eventually sort of learned how to get started from, and that was from, picking a category on Amazon to creating a cover to formatting to, I mean, I knew how to write the book, that bit I knew, but everything else, editing and marketing and all that stuff and starting a mailing list, and I didn't know any of that, so I had to learn all that. Now that took, months of sort of study, and I thought, well, if I could condense all that down, sort of everything I learned to get to the point where I had like my first audiobook out, for example. So every step that I kind of went through, if I could condense that down into a course, and I thought it'll be, a few lessons. It ended up being about 30 different less parts to this course and doing. And I thought if I do that and I put that out, and all the really at the moment we're kind of I'm working with my son on it. He was kind of you doing it as his sort of project, the actual I created the content, I made the course, he's building all the stuff around it, which is quite handy at the moment because, as I mentioned earlier, before we started the podcast, he's had an accident recently, so he's got a lot of time sitting down. So he's kind of developing the website around it and all that stuff. But I emailed sort of some people who'd been in touch via my reader list and said, give this a try. And we've had a couple of hundred people going through it so far. We've got all their feedback. And then we've just finished sort of implementing that feedback into the course to make it better. And now we're about to sort of take it wide, so to speak, and start marketing it to other people. So It's been an interesting experience, very different thing, but yeah, it gave me that sort of opportunity to kind of go back to where I was, 8 years ago, and to look at what's changed in that time as well, and what because the advice 8 years ago doesn't necessarily translate to today, although a lot of it does, a lot of the core stuff does. So it's basically about, it condenses all that information down, how you can self-publish a book on Amazon KDP without spending. Theoretically, at least, without spending any money on the process, apart from the cost of the course.
Yeah, and it's incredibly reasonable
Yeah,
compared to a lot of others so that are, four
yeah. Well, I
figures.
wanted to keep it. I mean, that's the point. It was. I want to get that information out there, and it's people that are trying to do this for free don't have a lot of money to spend.
No, it's
So I wanted
true.
to make sure it was priced sort of well under, 100 quid. And it's sort of several months of knowledge accumulation and things I've learned implementing all that stuff, and yeah, that's sort of pretty much available now. It'll be properly available sort of before London Book Fair, so by the end of this week.
Awesome. Did anything surprise you reflecting on that? I mean, because you've achieved an enormous amount in that period. But did anything, oh, I haven't, I'd forgotten that, or anything that stood out when you were in going through that process?
I think for me, I found some things that work, and I've consistently kept doing them. And the main thing for me that's worked is building a community, and that's been, it's I never think, and I've never been able to do it. When I did school events, and I go into schools to talk about my kids' book, the publisher would say, go and tell them to, get them to buy the book, and I hate that. I hate being sold to. I hate selling to people. So I kind of go, well, hey, here's a lovely time. You can have a fun time with these kids and get them excited and riled up about the story and all that stuff. And then the books are available. And if they decide then they want to go, they've enjoyed themselves so much that they want to go and buy that book, then great. But I don't have to put that book in their hand and say, give me some money. So I've tried to kind of replicate that. So for me, it's been about building a community, mostly through the mailing list. So I'll be, telling them about things that have been happening to me and fun things in my life, or exciting things, or terrible things, and just having that conversation. And it's always been about a conversation, whether that's on social media, whether that's on newsletters, whether that's on the blog, any of that stuff. So that's what I kind of did from the start, and that's continued to work for me. I also did, when I went and looked back at things, other things I'd done at the start, I'd done like trying to get people on my mailing list. I thought, oh, I need a big mailing list. So I was like, have some free stuff, and there's a competition, win this thing and join my mailing list. And you discover as you go on that these subscribers are largely worthless. It's like, well, you want a free thing and you will never buy anything from me, and you're certainly not interested in hearing from me. I often say you could have a million people on your mailing list who never buy anything, or you could have one who buys everything. And one of those things is a valuable asset, and one of them is a massive financial drain. So the number of people you've got on your list is irrelevant. So I, looking back, I kind of thought, well, these are all the things that I did, which now I wouldn't do. I can see why I did them at the time. You get caught up in that thing of, I want a big number of subscribers. And you don't need a big number of subscribers. You need a few subscribers that really like you. And the way you get them to really like you is by having genuine, authentic kind of conversations with them. Whether that's you making a video and talking about what you've been up to that day, or direct communication by email. You know, I send out an email newsletter and I will get 300 responses that day from people who are just telling me what they've been up to and things like that, or kind of going, oh, sorry to hear about that, or loved reading about that, or whatever it may be. And that relationship is what continues to sell books. They're not just interested in the stories, they're interested in my success. They're invested in me as a human being as well as an author.
How do you refresh your creative world, given, I mean, so a lot of people listening to this thinking five books, five and a half books, three screenplays, that's you, at some point you're going to run out of juice, surely.
Well, so
That's what they're
far,
going to think.
I mean, I started doing this, started writing full time in 2008. So what's that?
10,
six,
15 years, 16 years.
16, 16. Yeah, 16 years. So far, touch wood, I have never not had ideas to write. You know, I've got a notebook that could keep me going. Even if I never have another idea again, I have a notebook that can keep me going for the next, decade, at a similar rate to what I'm writing at the moment. And I feel, especially with the series stuff, so with the DCI Logan series, it's like sort of just hanging out with people you really know, so it's
Your
like saying,
friends.
yeah, exactly, that's it. So it's like that sort of thing going, like, oh no, I'm not going to hang out with them now because we've already said everything that we're going to say. And it's like, of course not. You're going to, you will have new conversations and new experiences together and all that stuff. And that's what it's like when I go back into a book in a series. It's like I'm catching up with them, and I'm interested to know what they've been doing in the last sort of, 4 or 5 months, however long has passed since the previous book. I desperately want to know what they've been up to. So it's almost like me catching up with friends. But as soon as I do that, then those characters just come to life in my head, and they'll be like, I don't see them, but they come to life in my head. And I can sort of go, okay, this is what they've done. And then I get their conversation, I get snapped back into that flow of conversation. And I almost think, like, when I'm sitting typing, because I type very quickly, luckily, but it's almost like my fingers are doing all the work and I'm reading it a split second later. Like, so it's like there's like a subconscious thing almost. So I'm just typing and I'm reading it going, oh, that's quite good.
You're just a
And
vessel, really.
yeah, I think
Because
it does feel a
you've
bit
got
like
this
that sometimes, yeah.
community of characters, so as well as your community of readers,
Yeah.
you built up this community of characters that, by the way you're talking, they're as real to you as they are to your
Absolutely.
readers.
Absolutely. So, like, when I do bad things to them, like, I have been, I literally, I won't spoil anything, but one of the books in the sixth DCI Logan book, something terrible happens to one of the characters in their life, like a big traumatic life moment. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll do that. That's what's going to happen. And as I wrote it, I burst into tears. I literally felt so awful for what I had done. I still did it because I'm a horrible, vengeful god. But I felt so horrible that I literally just spontaneously burst into tears. And that can happen. Sometimes I can be sitting writing a scene, or just writing a scene in the new book, and it's just a conversation between two like really old friends who've kind of had this something has come up between them to sort of disrupt that relationship. And just writing that scene, I could feel myself welling up, thinking the pain that they're both going through and can't communicate to each other, and it made me quite emotional as well.
That's interesting.
I mean, it sort of reminds me, Rebecca, or perhaps remember this. I came out of my audio booth where I'd been narrating.
Oh, when you shouted at the cat because you'd been fighting Romans.
Well, it was the Roman series, so it Gorgon Doherty's books set in legionary times, and these characters, I've done all of the books for the series, mm-hmm. and he's just about right number 10. So in book 7, two of the major characters got bumped off that we've been with them all the way through, and favorite voices to do. And I was in absolute floods as they died.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, as I
they do become real. That's it. I mean, I know those characters better than I know, you know, well, better than I know myself, but better than I know, you know, my real friends. You know what I mean? I know the sort of ins and outs of their lives better than anyone else I know. So, of course, you get emotionally invested in them. Mm. Sometimes you have to do bad things to them.
Yeah. And so what you're saying, as long as they exist, then the stories will exist.
Yeah, because, that's it. Exactly. Yeah.
In real life.
Well done on bringing it back around to the actual question there, because I forgot what the question was and I'm just going to keep talking long enough. but yes, that's it. Exactly. So as long as I can think of characters, as long as characters pop into my head, which happens on a daily basis, you know, 200 times, then I think there will still be stories to write.
You've embarked on a new crime series in D.I. Heather Filson.
Yes.
So given, was that in any time, did you feel that was taking a creative risk, or was it something you needed to do because you wanted to create new characters in a new setting, but drawing on your experience of the Logan books and writing, you know, police procedurals and murder mysteries and whatever?
Yeah, so it did feel... There have been, it's a spin-off from the DCI Logan series, the DI Heather Filson series. So it's the second spin-off I did. The first spin-off was the Robert Hoon thriller series, which has been described as, what was it described as now? Die Hard meets Trainspotting, which was quite nice. So the reason I did that one was that I got a lot of emails from readers about this character, Bob Hoon, and half of them were saying, he's the greatest character in the series. We love him and I want more of him. And half were saying, I hate this man. He's foul-mouthed. He's uncouth. He's, you know, he's just horrible. I skip over all the scenes he's in. And I thought, right, I want to try and convince that half to like him. I want to take the same guy, not change his character in any way, but make you empathize with him and make you go, actually, I am, despite the fact that I hated him, you know, in the DCI Logan series, I now love him and I want him to succeed. So it was almost a challenge to myself doing that. And for the most part, that seemed to have worked. And people love him and the books do very well and that's all great. But then this other character appeared in it, D.I. Heather Filson, appeared in the Logan series, and everyone hated her. Like almost, I would say, certainly in the first time she appears, everyone despises her. She kind of slightly redeemed herself a little bit in a later book, but that was because I knew at that point that I wanted to do something with her. It was like, right, I'm going to start this process of you being on board with her. So she remained, again, like I had to keep her as quite a kind of unpleasant, prickly character, and because otherwise there's no point in going, I'm going to make you like her, and the way I'm going to do that is by changing everything about her and making her a nice character. So she's still quite an unpleasant character. She's still not someone you would necessarily want to hang out with or be friends with or work with. But I wanted to at least let readers understand why she is the way she is and what makes her that. So I thought, I'm going to take her and I'm going to do this spin-off. And people keep saying, you know, or do one about, you know, DC Tyler Nish, who's this sort of, you know, slightly awkward, clumsy junior detective, or the pathologist, you know, Shona McGuire. They said, do one about her. And but then they were saying, like, literally, you know, but don't do one about Heather because she's a cow. And it was like, right, well, that's definitely
that's a challenge.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So
yeah,
almost out of spite. But just mostly for that challenge to myself, going, okay, can I take this character that everyone hates and make you root for her? And not necessarily like her, but root for her and empathize with her and want her to succeed. So that was why I did the first book. And it did... It changed a lot of minds, which was nice. I got a huge amount of very positive feedback about Heather, and the book did really well. So I thought, right, I'm going to do another couple of these at least. Because again, in creating that, there were these other characters that appeared. There was, you know, Heather's dad, who's got dementia, and she's kind of caring for him. And there's this old sort of old time Glasgow gangster called Shuggy Cowan, and it was all, anyway, he's, you know, way past his prime, and he's maybe trying to trying to be a bit better than he was and make amends for things he's done. But the first book is about his granddaughter, who he's just recently sort of connected with. He's found out he's got a daughter, but his granddaughter goes missing, and he thinks it's, you know, some old rival of his, and it turns out to be something kind of even more sinister than that. And it's so Heather is kind of forced, despite the fact they have this really sort of fractious relationship, because obviously he's a criminal. There's a lot of stuff they can't prove, but, you know, he's done time. She's in the police. She thinks he's been involved in her brother's disappearance a few years ago. Her brother worked for him, and so there's this really difficult relationship. But they're forced to kind of come together to sort of deal with this situation they find themselves in. So and it was just great fun to write. It was doing that. You know, there's a podcaster in it. It's like a 14-year-old autistic girl, and she has this true crime podcast, and people loved her. And it was like, she was kind of based on my daughter as well. So we made a trailer for the podcast that Ace does in the show, in the book series, sorry. And it was just great fun. It was just playing with all this new, this sort of connected world, but it's all these new people, you know. And it's and there was some crossover, you know. There'd be characters who had appeared in the Logan books, and they appear in it, and it was just such good fun to do, and the readers seemed to be on board with it. So I thought, yeah, I'm just going to keep doing this. And I've been
Amazing.
fortunate enough that that's been, you know, throughout my whole career, I've been able to go, that's a fun thing to do. You know, whether that's writing this or writing for the Beano or whatever, it's going, that's a fun thing. And I've been able to do that until the point when something else has come up and I've gone, right, I'm going to try and go in this direction now.
Amazing. And before we get to the random question, which is imminent, in terms of your process, because I mean, we talk about writing very quickly, but what I'm really interested to know is your quality control element, because writing so many books and releasing, I mean, there are a number of other authors who have done that and been very successful, but perhaps some of the criticism I hear of them from readers is it's slipping, it's it came out too quickly, it hasn't been polished. What's your process to make sure that you're happy with it?
So I write a pretty clean first draft, by no means a perfect first draft, but my first draft is pretty much story-wise where I want it to be. I will then go through and do a couple of passes myself, just sort of tidying it up, you know, proofing it. It'll then go to my editor, Hannah, who will then kind of tear it to bits. We'll bounce that back and forward a little bit and sort that out. It then goes to a sort of team of proofreaders who are all kind of waiting for it. They'll read it. They'll give me their feedback. At that point, the story's all, you know, locked down. It's basically just that character's a bit annoying or doing, and a lot of their feedback is things I'll maybe take into future books rather than necessarily using in that one. But they also help, you know, spot a lot of typos and things that have slipped through. And that's basically it. And that's basically the process. So it goes through a few different levels of people poking around in it. But the first draft's generally 90% there. Yeah. And I think that a lot of that comes from experience. You know, as I say, I did 180 kids' books working for HarperCollins and Penguin, and I was fortunate enough to work with lots of really good editors. And in that time, the writing's like anything else. The more you do, the kind of better you get at it, or the easier it becomes, at least. So, you
I'm more
know,
confident as well in what you're
yeah.
doing.
So I know the shape of a story. I know what, you know, if I go, this needs to happen here. If this doesn't happen here, this is not a compelling story. And this, you know, I need to have this question asked here, and it won't get answered till there. And then, you know, so all that stuff is quite instinctual now. So that's why the first drafts are pretty close to being where that, you know, ready to go. But still, you know, a long way in terms of typos and maybe continuity things, like, you know, Hannah will say, yeah, that character died 3 books ago, and I'll go, yeah, okay,
That's why you use the
forgot about
same
that,
editor,
forgot that,
because they
forgot about
remember
that.
all that,
Absolutely,
yeah.
yeah, absolutely.
but if it was summing up this conversation in a sense, the thing that's coming through that I'm sort of picking up really is the openness with which you still have you haven't settled on a personal formula, and you're going to just this is what I do. I'm not going to listen. You're very open to, your community, the people that are feeding back to you, and that's feeding your creative process and taking you in directions. In the case of Heather Filson, you know, that you didn't perhaps expect.
Yeah. It may be that I'm doing sometimes doing the opposite of what the community asks for, but it's certainly influencing me. You know, that certainly happens. And I think, as soon as you become too rigid on anything, it stops being fun, I think. Mm. It just becomes formulaic. And it's stifling creatively. You know, so some books I will plan out in reasonable detail, often don't stick to the plan, but I'll plan them out. And some I'll go, right, I know who the killer is, I'll work my way to that. You know, I'll start here and I'll work my way there. And there's been times I've gone, oh, that's not the killer. The killer's someone else. You know, and that's, yeah. And suddenly it's like, oh, yeah, okay, now I need to change everything and go back through and seed in clues and all that stuff. So I think, yeah, generally being open to kind of both ideas in the terms of in an individual book, but also in different, you know, other things you can do surrounding those books. So one of the things we're doing at the moment is I don't think I've mentioned this anywhere yet, but we're doing a game, like a PC game based on the D.I. Heather Filson series.
Oh, wow.
Which is a sort of interactive movie type thing when you're solving the crime.
Okay.
So that is something that would never have necessarily occurred to me, but then it was sort of mentioned that it was like, okay, let's explore that and let's see where that leads
That's
us.
Fantastic.
And now we're kind of partnered up with a studio and we've got a meeting about it this week. And so that's just something else that's happening. And I think that to me as well, being a bit sort of evangelical about indie publishing, is that I can't do that with any of the books I wrote for HarperCollins, because HarperCollins have those rights. You know, if someone came to me and said, we want to make like a movie of your horror series that you did, you know, 10 years ago, I was like, okay, well, I'll try and find an email address for a rights person at HarperCollins, and they may or may not get back to you. And as past experience tend to go by, they probably won't. But having the, you know, I keep all the rights to everything. So I did, you know, I did comics based on my Space Team book series, and we're doing this game thing. You know, we kept the rights for the film stuff, for the romance books, and it's that one of the reasons I wouldn't really switch back to. I wouldn't drop being indie in favour of being traditionally published again.
Yeah,
fair enough. Interesting. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Here it is. The what a way to top and tail this interview. But here is Rebecca's random question.
Okay. So we mentioned earlier we drove to Wakefield from where we live in Staffordshire.
Yes.
And I actually asked my 14-year-old son for a random question because I didn't have any ideas, and he said, "So this is from him." He wants to know, when you're on a motorway and you want to stop at a service station, what is the most exciting thing at the service station that you look forward to?
probably the bathroom. If I stop, that's probably the reason why. But I don't know. I'm in my, because up here in the Highlands, we don't have motorways. I need to drive, you know, 2 hours to hit a motorway. Yeah. We have single track roads for a lot of it. So if I'm going sort of down, driving down to England, then we'll pass TBay services. Then I look forward to everything in TBay services. I look forward to the food, just as much of the food as possible. So generally it would be an emergency dash to the toilet if I'm on it. But otherwise, the food at TBay services.
Totally.
Yeah, he's with you on that.
Yeah, and then obviously by extension, if you get further south, Gloucester services.
That's a long way though.
Same.
Never tried there.
It looks like Teletubby land.
It's TBay.
It's like this sort of Teletubby land, green grass on the roof thing.
Yeah, they've done a sort of eco roof. It is extraordinary.
I used to like it, but I don't know.
You've gone off it.
I've gone off it a bit, but.
Well, yeah. For me to get to TBay services is, I think, about 6 hour drive.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Thereabouts. So by the time you get there, you're very desperate.
Crossing the legs while driving is not easy, but sometimes it's a necessity. That's because I'm quite north, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It's always funny. I was, you know, when I'm down in England and things are heading up, you know, heading home, and then I'll see signs that say the north. And go, right, so to get to the north, I have to drive 5 hours due south. to hit the north.
Yeah,
That's where I
yeah.
am, you know. So,
The north set starts a lot lower than where you are.
Yes, yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Well, that's the arrogance of the English, isn't it?
It is totally. Yeah,
like, this is the north. Everything above this is just wild lands.
Yeah, we don't know what's
which is
beyond
probably
that.
It's probably fair enough, to be honest.
Yeah, no. It's but you're in a beautiful spot. Fort William is just amazing.
What do you look forward to? I'm going to say Waitrose or M&S because you do like poppering
I
around
must admit
M&S.
That you know there are two logos that will drag
Leon's.
a Leon on a motorway. Obviously, what you were saying about T-Bay stroke Gloucester services will always make a stop there, even though I don't need to.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's an M&S food, happy
yeah.
Days.
Well, see what used to happen because when I was doing children's books and I would drive all over the UK, and it would be to talk at schools, to talk at libraries, because that's what, so. But what would always happen was, like, I gained a colossal amount of weight because what would happen was I'd go to like I'd fill up a petrol here saying I was going to go, and then it was like, right, I'll buy a sandwich to eat, you know, later on up at the road, and I'll buy a bag of crisps, and I'll buy, or it's a meal deal and it's great, okay, I'll get that and I'll get some chocolate. And literally, you know, by the time I'm out of the service station, I've eaten half of it. Like, it's that thing of like going, right, oh, it's all gone. I'm 2 miles down the road and all the food's eaten. So then it's like, right, okay, now I'm getting hungry again. So I'd stop at the next service. And then I'd just sort of piggyback my way down any motorway, just stopping at every service station, going, I'll just grab that. Oh, they've got a Burger King. I'll just grab that. And I'm just bored of my driving because it's like I'm driving all the time. I'm so bored. What will make it more interesting? Because podcasts weren't even really a thing back then, particularly.
No.
So it was like, right, I'm fed up listening to the radio. I'll just eat some food. And it became, and you know, not that I recommend this, and I don't do it now, but I became a master of eating an M&S sandwich one-handed while hurtling down the motorway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm there with you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I have done that a few times.
Yeah.
With the Diet Coke in between my legs, and I'm just unscrewing the
bottom. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's going, come on, slide on for a second, still see the road. Yeah.
The crisps are dripping all down my front. And I'm like picking them out later.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Inevitably, I'll turn up at the school event and I'd be covered in food. I'd just be like, yeah, so don't mind me. Half a sausage roll stuck behind my ear and everything. You know.
Brilliant. Well, look, JD, it's been absolutely magnificent to speak to you again. And we're looking forward to seeing you in person then, if we're both, we're all going to be at London Book Fair.
Down London next week,
which should be terrific. But in terms of people who, this is their onboarding point with your world, where can they find you online?
I would just suggest go to just jdkirk.com. And there should, I think, be links to everything from there. So the Facebook kind of community, the mailing list, and there'll be a link to the course somewhere on there as well. So jdkirk.com.
Fantastic.
Brilliant.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you again.
Isn't it interesting the way that JD talks about how little character description he actually adds into his books and he leaves it for the reader? I think that's fascinating because this is a spectrum that we have debates with our authors at Hoback about, you know, this is overdoing it or this is underdoing it or whatever.
Mm.
And it's a personal taste thing. I mean, he's very comfortable. I mean, as he says, his main character, DCI Logan, he's a big bloke in a big coat.
Yeah,
that's it.
That's all he knows.
That's fascinating.
But what interests me is when he was talking about that, I immediately saw a big bloke in a big coat, and I saw what he looked like, his hair, his face, everything. But that he's almost saying, that's not my job. My job is to give you the sort of the bare bones of what this character's like. You, because you have a visual mind, you can come up with him.
Absolutely. Well, in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to be talking to, we did the interview this week, and it was brilliant.
Yeah, I know,
with
another one.
Tim Maleeny, who is a US author of crime fiction, but sort of with humour.
Yes.
Very similar to J.D. Kirk, looks up to J.D. Kirk as well. And Tim has a very powerful job in New York City, but writing is his passion. And again, we touch on a lot of the things, same sort of themes. How do you weave in, you know, humour into crime situations? People are dying, but nonetheless, there's fun there.
And how do you get into the head of something you've never been?
Right.
Like an octopus. But anyway.
So Tim's coming up, and our guest next week is a Hoback author.
Yes.
Stacey Murray.
Because we're publishing The Thief of Joy a week tomorrow. So, yes, we're talking to Stacey all about that and what it's like to be a Hoback author.
And, of course, we will be weaving in some elements of our week because we have, quite simply, it will be probably the most bonkersly busy week of the year for us. We're heading down to Dorset tonight to there's a gathering of Ackroyd Publishing executives.
Yes. So
Rachel McLean's Ackroyd Publishing, and we're holding there's a public event, a balloon debate between Rachel herself and her editor Joel.
Well, her co-author.
Her co-author as well, but editor of her books, and they're going to be playing various characters, deciding who stays in the balloon, who doesn't. But so that's a balloon debate thing, and then there's a lot of time spent talking about the future of Rachel's business,
and we're going to go for walks and eat food and
so that's busy. And then London Book Fair for us Thursday.
Yeah,
we're going down for the whole day, up and down in the day, meeting with the likes of Rachel and JD Kirk.
Yeah,
and
see Rachel again, it'll be quite funny.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, you know, we've also got some thoughts as to what we want to get out of it.
Yeah, I've got one meeting as well so far, so
you know, but
busy day.
There's a lot we can get from it. So we will reflect on London Book Fair as well, and the interview with Stacey, and perhaps we'll capture a little bit of the spirit of Dorset as well.
We might be able to, yeah, that'd be good.
So it's a busy old one.
And I'm determined to get my foot in the sea somehow.
You will, because, well, Wareham was on Poole Harbour, so you'll be fine. You're not far from the sea.
You might have to dip me down into the harbour then.
No. It's a beautiful area. I holidayed there when I was a teenager, and I just had a brilliant time.
I haven't seen the sea since August, and we went to visit Lynn LaVersha. That's the last time I saw the
sea. Well, you need it. You need that recharge. I will try and turn away while you put your feet in the woods, because it just, I have some sort of synesthesia issue.
It is a synesthesia thing, because synesthesia extends to feeling pain when you perceive another person in pain.
If I think of somebody walking in water with their bare feet, then I'm in pain. I'm in pain now as I say it.
Well, okay, I hope you don't mind me giving this example. We went for a walk round Hobet Towers the other day, and I love to walk bare feet, and I walked down the road with bare feet, and you couldn't look at me. You had to walk in front of me.
Yes.
And you're probably feeling pain now.
Oh, God. Oh, just a wave, just literally as you said that. It just hit me, and it sort of emanates from my feet up through my calves. If it's really bad, it hits the rest of me.
And so that is synesthesia.
It's extraordinary. Yeah. And it's quite debilitating, because I sometimes get it when I'm driving. If I see somebody walking alongside the road, or they're hobbling in some way or something like that, I'm off.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling it. And sometimes it gets so bad I shut my eyes and I'm driving.
But is it
just a couple of seconds? But you know,
is it specific to that, or if somebody you saw somebody with a bleeding elbow?
Oh yeah,
I mean, you feel it in your elbow though.
I didn't used to have this, but as I think I mentioned a few months ago on the podcast, when I was a journalist, I was sent to situations where I saw things that, you know, normally you film terrible things and then you decide not to show it to the public.
Yeah.
So I've seen some pretty horrific road traffic accidents, or the impact
of
burning buildings on people. You know, I didn't have it before then, and it's become a thing.
Mm.
And I think that's.
I think scientists would like to study you. You know, because there are people who do study this. Not condition, neurological quirk, I guess it is. Because I have synesthesia, but mine is a colour, number, letter, music,
yes,
and sound.
Yours is a practical one. It's a good one.
No, I wouldn't say it's practical. I suppose it is if I need to remember a number.
Yeah.
But I also, I hear sound. So like those leaves, you can't hear those leaves out the window, but I can sort of hear them. That's synesthesia as well.
They're crying.
No, not that sort of thing. I can, my brain has conjured up the rustle of the leaves, even though I can't actually hear them.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, look, we're going to wrap up the show.
We jab it on.
So Stacey and our guest next week, we have the most bonkers week, and the room that we're in at the moment is surrounded with equipment that I've been digging out from all the locations, because I've got some videoing to do tomorrow, and on Monday rather.
That is tomorrow.
Today as we put this podcast out.
Sorry.
So today. And it's quite a sort of operation, you know, someone say, oh, well, can you provide video? Fine. Can you do some sound? Yeah. But then you forget just how much kit and how many cables and chargers and all the other stuff that you need. And I've forgotten that. I haven't done it for a few years. And I've, to my shame, been pulling out bits of equipment where the batteries have leaked and destroyed, you know, radio mics and all sorts of things that I've had over the years. But anyway, almost ready. Got to pack the car and head off tonight down towards Dorset and the start of Bonkers Week.
Yes, Bonkers Week. Let's call it that.
So we'll join you again for the next episode of the Hopcast after Bonkers Week with Stacey Murray as our guest and a few other little tidbits of other people, I'm sure. And it remains for us to say, well, first of all, thank you for listening to us. Don't forget to go to the website, www.hobeck.net, for details of everything that we do. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you, and have a wonderful and...
creative and bonkers
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.